Today's program has been brought to you by GreatBrewers.com, a social media marketing platform dedicated to promoting the world's great brewers and the beers they create. For more information, visit GreatBrewers.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni from Jimmy's Number 43. It's October 16th, 2012. We're in the middle of Cider Week, New York, here at Roberta's in Bushwick. We're sponsored by GreatBrewers.com. Thanks to them, you can check out Beer Cloud and the Great Beer Test. You can learn more about beer at GreatBrewers.com. And thanks to our community of Good Beer Seal bars, GoodBeerSeal.com. You can learn more about places to get really good beer and cider in New York City. And here I am with Dave Broderick from Blind Tiger and the new Worthy Burger up in, South Royalton, Vermont?
Hey, Jimmy. Yep, South Royalton.
You know, it's appropriate that you're here on our Cider Week show because, you have made cider and one of my favorite ciders ever you made with your buddies from Fable Farm up
there.
That's
right. Hopefully we can do it again. No cider this year, but hopefully next year.
Well, it's great to have the cider show on. Sarah Grady is from Glenwood.
Hey, Jimmy.
And you're one of the creators of Cider Week. Welcome to the show.
Thanks.
And we have our home brewers who've been on before, our home cider makers. We've got Joy and Jeremy from what they call Proper Cider.
Hello.
All right, welcome back. And we're going to have Steve Wood from Farnham Hill and Dan Wilson from Sly Bro Cider calling in later in the show. All right, guys, so we're drinking cider. You guys are Joy and Jeremy. You're the first people we'll talk to. I love what you guys do. A year or two ago, you were on the show. You talked about how you made cider at home. Mm-hmm. You made some funky stuff. You made some good stuff. How long have you been making cider at home now?
Well, we picked up our first pile of apples in 2004 from the green market, brought them home, and made, out of like 60 pounds of apples, made, I don't know, 2 gallons, something like that, 2 or 3 gallons. And then from there, every year we doubled until we make a little over 100 gallons. This year will be different because there's a big apple problem in New York, as you've heard about. But yeah, we've been doing it since about 2004.
Upgraded from the green market.
Yeah.
All right. Well, one thing, last time you were on, we posted on our blog on the Group Seal. It said these are the steps to making home cider. It said harvest, sweat, wash and chop, grind, press, ferment, taste and blend and bottle.
It's essentially everything that you do to make like a wine, really. I mean, we ended up calling our cider Proper Cider because we spend so much time explaining to people what it is. Now, all those steps there that you listed, that wouldn't apply to someone who just buys juice. You know, if you just buy juice and pitch yeast in it, that's going to make cider too. It's not what I would call proper cider, though. Proper cider, you know, starts with apples.
And not all apples sweat. We've learned some apples actually don't sweat very well.
Why don't you explain the sweating process? Because I don't think a lot of people know that and why it's so important to do that.
Okay, so you pick an apple off the tree. It's maybe not exactly ready to turn into a cider. It's maybe not sweet enough. The sugars haven't developed. Take it home and let it hang out. Let it just breathe a little bit. The moisture evaporates. The sugars condense, and you're going to get a little bit more higher alcohol. So, you know, depending on the kind of apple, if it's like a russet, if it's a more hardy apple, it can sweat a really long time. And I know apple growers have like nitrogen rooms. They can keep apples indefinitely, you know, at least a year. But we have pests, and you know, you can't keep them in the house because then your fruit flies come. And so we'll sweat them for a week or two if they're not ready, and then they dehydrate a little of the water leaves. Then it's time to grind them up. And then the grinding part's the most difficult thing for a home cider maker because you can't just do it in a You can do it in a food processor. It just takes a long time. Our buddy Andre used a food processor. I think he burnt one out doing it. We used to use a Juice Man Junior, like a little, you know, consumer juice maker. But eventually, you know, it takes about a bushel of 45 pounds to make 2 or 3 gallons. So as you can see, you need a big grinder.
So it's expensive too.
Well, yeah, unless you build a grinder. I built one out of a garbage disposal. It was the first time it had ever been used. It was stainless steel, so it doesn't affect the apple acids or anything. But yeah, the grinding is the tough part. When we did use like a food processor, Juice Man, we would take the pulp and we knew there was juice still in that apple pulp, and we put it in like sanitized pillowcases to wring it out. And now I built like a hydraulic shop press. I turned it into a, Joy's going to show you a photo. I turned it into
do you guys have a site where we can learn more about this too?
Well, yeah, propercider.com. I think I own that one. Slantycider.com. At least find it on Facebook, Proper Cider. Just use the Google machine.
You Dave, won't learn anything there as much as you will by visiting our Facebook page, yeah. Probably.
Are they doing what your guys up in Vermont are doing or other small cider makers are doing?
Yeah, definitely what we're doing. We pretty much follow those steps as much as possible. Have a hydraulic press with it that has a really, you know, pretty good grind. I mean, it's the press is from 1908, but the grinder's been updated a few times. And we definitely try to sweat the apples, and you know, especially as the as we get late into the season. I don't know if you guys have done any late harvest apples.
Those are the best ones.
Yeah. So it really changed. Like when I first start pressing in August, the cider is like pretty low in alcohol, you know, 4%, and ferments really, really fast. And then I notice it takes longer and longer as the season, you know, as the sugar goes up and the season progresses, it takes longer. And is more interesting in taste.
All right. Well, hey, Cider Week next. So Sarah Grady from Glenwood, tell us how you got involved with working with the Apple Project. Tell us a little about that and how that led to Cider Week New York.
Yeah, so Glenwood is an agricultural nonprofit in the Hudson Valley, and our mission is to support the viability of farms in the region. So we got interested in hard cider as an opportunity for orchards. There have been a lot of challenges for orchards over the last couple decades. So hard cider is a higher value product that can help those orchards to be more viable. And we started last year with an exchange program between a group of producers in the Hudson Valley and a group of cider and Calvados makers in Normandy, France. And as I was putting that project together, you know, I started reaching out to some of the more established craft cider makers in the Northeast and asking them, what's your biggest challenge right now? And they kept talking about developing the market, cultivating the market, and the fact that cider really doesn't have a category in the industry. So we started talking about what we could do to build more awareness of cider, more appreciation for real craft cider. And Cider Week, you know, the idea of Cider Week was born, and a lot of great partners and supporters like you, Jimmy, helped us get it off the ground. And last year was the first year sort of put the word out for bars and restaurants and shops to get on the cider train. And we had 100 establishments participating in the first year. And now in the second year, we have 200. And the idea really is just to get those establishments interested in cider and featuring cider and figuring out how to integrate cider into their, you know, whether it's a pub or a restaurant or a wine store. And, you know, it's been really amazing to watch the learning curve and watch the level of response rise just in a matter of a year.
The first year was really great. It was well run. And I would point to people, I would say, hey, if you want to find a list of the top restaurants and bars in New York, go to Cider Week. Because anybody that was, you know, Northern Spy in the East Village, they would have a nice list of 6 or 7 really good regional ciders. And that never happened. You could barely find 1 or 2 good ciders on any menu in New York before Cider Week. Yeah. I think you definitely made an impact on the market, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just been in the zeitgeist, first of all, you know, sort of cider's moment. But also, you know, I think those places that have joined Cider Week do already have, you know, a genuine interest in supporting regional producers. And there's actually also a lot of sophistication amongst this particular group of professionals that's responded to this. So it's not like we've had to sell it very hard to them.
What's the connection with the people from Normandy and Calvados?
Yeah, so we were invited to collaborate with this group of producers from a region of a southern part of Normandy called Le Perche, where they make a lot of cider in Calvados. And we put together a group of producers from the Hudson Valley, mostly cider makers, a couple of distillers, almost all growing their own apples. And we took them to France for a week last November.
So it's like a meeting of the minds, seeing how they
exchange.
Do it. Over there. Okay.
So which were some of the orchard growers and cider makers from America that you brought to France?
Well, Dan Wilson from Slybro, who's going to call in today. Jason Grisanti from Doc's Draft. Elizabeth Ryan from Hudson Valley Farmhouse. There's a really small producer up near Red Hook called Annandale Cidery, Adam and Doug Finke. Tim Dressel from Dressel Orchards, who just started Kettleboro Cider House. Joel Elder, who's the head distiller at Tuttletown. Derek Grout, who makes Core Vodka.
Soons?
Jeff Soons, yep. That's right, from Orchard Hill Cider Mill, which is in the process of launching right now. Uh-oh, I might have missed somebody. I'm going to be in trouble if I did.
That's a pretty good list of people.
Yeah, it's
were you there for this?
Yes.
This must have been interesting. You've got a bunch of upstate farmers hanging out in France with the French farmers.
Yeah, and we also hosted the French group in the Hudson Valley for a week. So we had the French team here in the States, and then we sent the Americans over to France for a week. And yeah, a lot of different perspectives and ideas.
You had some busy translators, probably.
We did. We had some good franglais.
Yeah, good.
Yeah.
Especially when you're drinking cider.
Oh, yeah. Question is, how much cider can you drink? Like, it's Cider Week in New York now, and I've enjoyed cider at several great events. And after a while, I'm like, you know, some of the ciders I really like, but I feel like it kind of sometimes fits. I think it's about cider styles. Like, mm-hmm. many of the styles are similar to like an aperitif or a light white wine, where they're refreshing and simple. I know that Steve Wood from Farm Mill, we were talking yesterday about, he feels that when he can actually run his cider through like a draft system, get a little more carbonation, he thinks that it can keep up with beer and other products. I think the real issue is the style. We're talking about bringing cider to market. It's the style, because so many of the bottled ciders are slightly sparkling or not sparkling at all. And I think when you run it through a draft system, it becomes a different beverage.
Mm. More of a session beverage, you think?
Yeah, definitely sessionable, because it's at some point it's not just tart and it does. I think that running through, like, I had Farnham Hill on draft at an event on Saturday. I could keep drinking that. Sometimes in the bottle, I can have two or three glasses, and then my palate wants something different.
Okay. Well, speaking of the French ciders, they retain a whole lot of residual sugar. They use the process of keeving. And personally, I love it. But if I have a whole bottle of it, my insides just go crazy, because there's a lot of sugar still in those. Whereas the stuff here, at least Farnham and the stuff that we're making, there's no sugar left. So, you know, your body, you know, if you're not used to that sugar.
But that is part of coming to market, is deciding what are the different ways to serve mm-hmm. the cider. Like, I know in France they have Pommeau, which is mm-hmm. one of my favorites. It's cider with some Calvados. You know, that takes it to a higher alcohol level. Mm-hmm. That's something nice to finish the meal. And we have done full cider dinners where there's so many styles. And I feel like that's where the American cider makers are just getting started. Where, like, the ones, like, I had Harvest Moon cider the other day, Farnham Hill cider. These are my go-to ciders, but they're still making, like, a simple style, no matter how good. So I feel like that there's a lot more room for them to grow, you know?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I keep trying to remind people is that there's this incredible diversity of ciders, you know? And because we haven't really had a thriving cider industry in this country for quite some time, it's just something that people are less familiar with. So they want to either say, well, is it a wine or is it a beer? You know, I mean, how do I think about it? And I just think you have to think of it as its own thing. And there are different styles, you know, that make it maybe fit more into like a beer culture. And then there are different styles that fit more into sort of a wine culture. And frankly, I think that's also why we're seeing this amazing range of locations participating in Cider Week, because you've got like craft beer joints, and then you've got fine dining restaurants. And you have things like Pommeau, which is typically consumed as an aperitif, but then you have ice cider, which is a dessert wine. I think that's the thing that people should be exploring. You know, introduce yourself to this world of cider, because there's so many different styles and different flavors.
And the Americans are still experimenting. You know, the French ciders, they're governed by a list of rules. They have to stay within these rules to make what they're making, because they have a long tradition. It's an AOC. It's like a Reinheitsgebot. It's a kind of set of rules. I mean, even in beer drinking, if it's an IPA, it's a certain IBU, right? It's got some rules to it. And the cider makers are trying a little bit of this, trying a little bit of that. Let's do a little bit in oak. Let's do carbonated. Let's do flat, like, you know, what we have here with Farnham. And we're still trying to figure everything out.
Yeah, that was actually one of the interesting dynamics of this exchange project, you know, was that this group of French producers is trying to get an AOC designation for their cider. So they, you know, they have guidelines that they have developed and that they're, you know, that they're adhering to. And then they come here and they see this wild innovation and experimentation. And on the one hand, it was really easy for them to, you know, tell us that we were doing things wrong. Yeah. And on the other hand, they were really jealous, you know, because they don't have that same inventiveness and freedom. And particularly, you know, all of the marketing opportunities that we have here, they don't have as much of that there. So there was a really interesting tension between this idea of tradition and quality and this idea of innovation and experimentation and openness.
It would be, in France, it would be illegal for me to travel around with this bottle in the car. That's how it is over there, because it has to be certified. It has to go through a set of rules. And if you're a producer, that's for the non-producer. If you're a producer and it tastes like that, it's not cider. You can't sell it. Sorry. Try again.
And what's the difference? I mean, what? How does proper cider? And I, you know, it's two different tastes going on here in these in both of these bottles. What, you know, what makes it
versus the French?
Yeah,
they do this process called keeving, which is just retaining residual sugar. You know, you have that in beer. You're able to. You've got sweeter, heavier beers. With our cider, we're making it more like a wine. But in France, they're doing it similar to a beer. They're retaining some of that residual sugar. You've got your demi-sec, your brut, and your doux. And it's just a different process that you go through to strip out some nutrients so the yeast stops working. And so it stays really sweet. And you can't make what we're doing. You have to have that residual sugar. Otherwise, it's not Normand.
Cool. All right. This is Going Somewhere. We'll be back in a few minutes talking with Steve Wood from Farnham Hill Cider on Beer Sessions Radio.
Child, in the morning I'm gone, because 12 hours here, 12 hours too long. 30 odd years, man, was like a crystal red. Listen, name me some time in your sister. 30 odd years, man, I've always known. Trouble always starts on that open road. Trouble always starts on that open road.
Listening to Easy Ride and Jazz by Brothers, featuring Damon Bolte on the Heritage Radio Network.org.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. We're out here at Roberta's in Bushwick enjoying some homemade cider from Proper Cider, Jeremy and Joy. How are you guys? Thank you so much for sharing this with us.
Thanks for bringing us on.
Yeah.
We love chatting about cider, and our friends are sick of it. You know, that's all we talk about.
Well, you're on the right show today. And we've got Steve Wood on the line from New Hampshire. Steve, are you there?
I am.
Steve, hey, Steve.
How are you, buddy? I was lucky to spend, we had a Harvest Beer and Cider event in Williamsburg on Saturday and a cider beer dinner last night at Jimmy's Number 43. I got to hang out with Steve Wood, and thank you, man. We had a great time.
Thank you, pal. That was it was fabulous. But I'm back in chilly New Hampshire now.
So we're doing what you said. We've got a couple of your ciders. We're going to start with the extra dry because I really like the Farnham Hill, the extra dry cider. It's one of my favorite ciders I had all weekend in New York. We've got some home cider makers here, Joy and Jeremy, Sarah Grady from Cider Week New York, and Dave Broderick from Blind Tiger. Steve, tell us about the extra dry and how that's different from your other ciders.
Well, I'll get a bottle open here, and we can talk. There we go. The extra dry is stone dry. When we say extra dry, we're not using the French champagne term. You know, French, extra dry champagne is fairly sweet. This stuff is completely dry. No residual sugar, no dosage, no return sugar. And it, like all of our ciders, is based on the bittersweet apples we grow. You know, a lot of different tannic varieties like Dabanat and Yarlington Mill and Madai Dor. That's what gives it its sort of a tannic structure. It's the underpinning. And the acidity in it comes from varieties like Wixen and Asopus Spitzenberg and Ashmead's Kernel. The idea of the stuff is just to... This is, in a way, it's our most straightforward cider, with the exception of its occasional cousin extra dry still, which doesn't even have bubbles. But this is the real deal. There's nothing in it but the fruit.
Steve, are these sides? Is this cider bottle conditioned? Are you carbonating inside that bottle?
No. It's not bottle conditioned. We have fooled around with bottle conditioning a fair bit, and actually, bottle conditioning isn't. Bottle conditioning almost isn't a phrase that's appropriate for cider. The method Champenoise, or the Charmat method, the first being a secondary in bottle secondary fermentation, and the second being in a tank, which are where that's where you get a natural secondary fermentations and bubbles therefrom. We fooled around with those, and we don't really very much like what that does to the aromas and flavors of the of this fruit as, you know, as it's expressed when it is fermented to dryness and allowed to mature. So all of our bubbly ciders are actually, they are carbonated. They're carbonated. We do this very, very slowly in very cold conditions, slowly meaning over the course of a few weeks, just trickling CO2 back into the cider through a stone. Which gives it doesn't give the same kind of tiny bubble that you get from a secondary fermentation, but what it does is to preserve all of the flavors and aromas that you started with without adding things. You know, the elements that I think are very cool in champagne, but I think kind of intrude on delicate ciders like this.
But it's not the carbonation that's intruding. You're saying that the process actually changes the flavor a little bit.
Fermentation. I mean, whether you finish cider in a bottle the way a lot of the French guys do, or whether you induce a secondary fermentation, you're still getting all of those the aromas of fermentation in the bottle.
Yeah, the funkiness
and the flavors of fermentation in the bottle. And though in many cases I think those are pleasant, I don't think they. I think they intrude too much on the aromas and flavors that we are fondest of.
Steve, I'm going to take a real step back here. Yeah. You know, you're an apple grower as well. How is good cider, like the cider that you make, how is that different from apple juice?
From apple juice?
Yes. I wanted to ask that question.
It's got alcohol in it.
This is for the, everybody out there listening. Why is hard cider different than apple juice?
How is cider different from apple juice? Let's see. I mean, cider is
let me
to
count
apple
the ways.
Juice as wine is to grape juice.
Yeah.
So that's all there is to it. I mean, apple juice is the fresh express juice of apples. And I mean, and when you buy apple juice in the supermarket, it's usually been pasteurized and stabilized within an inch of its life. But it's also, you know, fresh cider is in effect apple juice. Fresh brown cider is in effect apple juice. And that's just unfermented, that's the unfermented juice of apples. But the word cider in every country in the world but the U.S., well, thank goodness now more and more in the U.S., denotes the fermented juice of apples in the same way that the word wine denotes the fermented juice of grapes. So one's fermented and one isn't. That's the whole deal.
That's good. I just wanted to ask you that question. Thank you.
I think he's pushing your buttons.
Well, it's good to hear from Steve. Yeah. I mean, if anyone's going to tell us, it's going to be Steve.
True.
Dave, we got Dave Broderick, who's made some cider himself. He owns a Blind Tiger in New York. Dave, you want to ask Steve any questions?
how many different kinds of varietals do you have in your orchard?
You mean apple varieties?
Yeah.
Well, we have a couple hundred, but... that's chiefly attributable to the fact that we're constantly experimenting. We're constantly doing grafting trials on varieties that we're interested in. We grow, in commercial quantities, I guess a couple dozen, of which about half or so are used in cider. I mean, we also grow eating and cooking apples. The orchard, it's a fairly good-sized, you know, commercial orchard. So and about half of our production is dedicated to cider. But the cider varieties, I don't know, 12, 13, 14, something like that. I haven't actually bothered to count them up.
And how many gallons of cider do you guys produce a year now at this point?
Oh, 17, 18,000, something like that, which is tiny in the drinks world, but God, it's a lot of juice to us.
Steve, I think I read that you're producing different varietals on the same tree, like experimenting with grafting on one tree. Is that normal? Are you doing that?
No, we're not producing. We when we do grafting trials, which is a way of getting a good look at how a variety will perform in your growing conditions. What we do is to graft it onto a branch, usually of an old Macintosh tree, because a settled down tree that's growing in one of our most typical orchards, typical of this place, I mean to say, so that we can get a sense as soon as possible of what of how that variety performs. But we've got a lot of trees that've got two or three varieties on them, but only experimentally. Well, actually, that's not true. There are a few places around the retail area where we've grafted more than one variety on, but that's just for show. It's just for people's amusement. You know, the orchards are solid blocks of several varieties in each orchard.
So, Steve, when you're trying to propagate the cider varieties that work for you in your climate, I mean, do you just plant seeds, or is what's the difference between planting seeds and grafting from the wood? I heard you talk about this on Saturday, so I'm still trying to understand.
The genetic information in an apple tree is not carried true in a seed any more than the genetic information is carried precisely true in a human. You don't look exactly like your brothers and sisters, and you don't look exactly like your parents, because we are all a mishmash of genetic information. The same is true of apple trees. Every seed is a product of cross-pollination between more than one tree, each of which carries its own genetic information. So if you planted all the trees off a Golden Delicious tree, you would get thousands of little trees, all of which would be related to the parent, but none of which would be identical to it or to each other. The genetic information is, however, carried true in the wood. So if you, grafting is a process of, it's vegetative propagation. It's a process of basically plugging a piece of wood into a growing tree, and everything from the point of the graft, the place where you put the things together, everything that grows beyond that is genetically identical to the parent, to the tree that from which you cut that piece of wood. So all apple trees, a Macintosh orchard or a Gala orchard or whatever orchard, those are all what they are because of grafting, not because of, you couldn't get them from seedlings. You would just get a complete mishmash, which would be interesting, but it would be a little bit difficult as a commercial venture.
All right. And Sarah Grady from Cider Week, do you want to ask Steve anything about grafting?
Well, yeah, I mean...
Well, the reason I say that is because I'm trying to get somewhere. Cider Week changed. Last year, it was more broad-based in New York. There were some European ciders and other American ciders. But this year it's really focused on the growers and the farm-based ciders in the Northeast.
That's right.
So I'm trying to say, Steve, you're saying that by being a grower and being able to graft your varieties and all that, the expertise that you have as a grower, do you think that makes you a better cider maker? How's that for a question?
Well, unequivocally, I mean, but this is a prejudice. Prejudice with me extends to wine as well. I mean, most of the wines I like best turn out to be made by the same outfit, the same family, or whatever that grew the grapes. I mean, I think having an intimate knowledge of your fruit and where it grew and how it grew, and actually, if you can, growing it yourself, which is not easy, but anyway, growing it yourself, the person who grows the fruit knows the fruit better than anybody else, and the person who knows the land and has worked on the same piece of land for a long time knows the land better than anyone else. And, again, this is a prejudice, but my favorite ciders and my favorite wines are ones that reflect the conditions in which the fruit is grown and reflect the fruit itself. So, yeah, just by definition, by my definition, this makes for better ciders. But that's not, please don't misunderstand, I'm not denigrating ciders made by people who aren't growing their own fruit. But I do think it gives you a leg up because you understand what you're working with. You understand the raw material and its provenance a great deal better if you've grown the damn thing yourself. So
yeah, and Steve, one of the things that I think people don't maybe realize about your orchard is that you essentially converted an orchard of eating apples to an orchard of apples that you may not want to eat because they're being grown for hard cider. And now you have really become a leader in advocating for other cider makers and other orchardists to grow those apples to help the cider industry expand. So my question then would be, as more and more of these true cider apple varieties are produced at a commercial scale, how do you think that that's going to affect the styles of ciders that are available in the American market?
Well, I think what it's going to do, I'm very pleased by this, and we give away a huge amount of grafting wood every year, but this year we've given away a great deal more than we ever have before to growers, which means that some of this fruit is actually going in the ground. And I think, and meanwhile, we sell thousands of gallons of juice, of this particular cider juice that we grow, all over the U.S., Oregon, Colorado, Virginia, all over the U.S., to cider makers who are beginning to understand that they can't make the ciders they want by just using Call dessert apples, you know, Call Red Delicious or Johnny Gold or whatever. There are lots of notions about regional styles, but I don't think a regional style really is going to develop anywhere until people are actually using the fruit that's grown, using the good fruit, good cider fruit that's grown in their region. And so I'm really encouraged by all the stuff that's going into the ground now, because what it suggests in my mind is that, first of all, there will be more good cider fruit out there, so the general level of quality of ciders is going to continue to rise, which it has been doing for the last decade or so. But also, there will be more and more ciders that really do reflect their regions, because they'll be made from apples, whether they're made from by the growers themselves or by somebody who's buying from their local grower, buying fruit from their local grower. They will reflect the growing conditions. They'll reflect the apples that those regions are really able to grow well. And every patch of ground imposes conditions on what can be grown well there. It doesn't matter whether it's apples, grapes, or, you know, kumquats. There are varieties of apples that can be grown to a very high standard here that can't be grown well in Virginia or wherever. The same is true in the reverse. There are a lot of apples that we can't grow for spit that grow brilliantly in other parts of the country or other parts of the world.
Why is that?
And as that evolves, and as people, growers, really good professional growers, start paying attention to what they can grow well, cider apples they can grow well, regional styles will start to emerge. And I think that's going to be very cool indeed.
Steve, one last thing. We just opened a bottle of the Kingston Black. Tell us about that and how it differs from your other ciders.
Are you all right? You okay? I haven't got any of that in front of me. Kingston Black is the only apple.
I stole one from the last dinner last night.
Yeah. Well, see, that's the only apple that it's the only single variety cider we make. And we believe here that most very good cider apples are lacking in something. The ones that provide tannic structure and, are usually low in acid. The acidic ones don't have much in the way of tannins. That's a very oversimplified version of something that's much broader than that. So most of the ciders that you get from us are blends of a number of different apples. But there are a few apples, and Kingston Black is one of them. It's a variety, Kingston Black, and it originated near Martock in Somerset in the southwest of England, and it's always had a reputation for being a nightmarish fruit of apple to grow. It's a very difficult tree, but for being able to make a really peculiar but, balanced cider in it by itself. And we grew a bunch of them. We don't grow a lot. We only make about 150 cases of that stuff a year. But it's an outlier. It's not really like our other ciders. It's made by the same approach as our other ciders, but it reflects the characteristics of that particular variety, which include all kinds of weird things like sort of musty forest floor mushroomy things and something faintly resembling, human affection. There's a lot of hormonal stuff in it. You know, muskmelon. There are all kinds of weird things going on. And it's got a little bit of a diacetyl-y, like almost butterscotchy characteristic. It used to scare the hell out of us until we figured out that it wasn't a defective fermentation or maturation, but actually a characteristic of the variety. We just do it because it's cool. We're not going to grow a lot more of it. You know, it's a lot of fun. It's not something that I think has enormous commercial potential or anything, but we enjoy making it.
So,
we enjoy drinking it, and the people. But sometimes people just, they get to the Kingston Black and their eyes light up and they get all excited. Sometimes people look at you as if you've tried to, poison them. So,
well, one thing I'll say. I know you also blend your other ciders.
It's up to an individual whether they like that stuff.
Steve, you're awesome. I know that you blend your other ciders, and this one is not a blend. Is that the case?
Yeah, it's the only one that's not a blend.
Yeah,
and we don't use it in blends either, because if you're tasting it now, you see it's got some very peculiar characteristics,
very,
and they are
very distinctive.
They do actually. Again, I was talking about secondary fermentation intruding on aromas and flavors. A lot of the stuff that we're looking for from these apples is pretty delicate. Kingston Black is pretty aggressive, and we just think it ought to just sit off in a tanker. I think 12 barrels going this year that we just started right before I came to New York for Cider Week. that's it for this year, you know, and they're fermenting happily by themselves, and they can bloody stay by themselves. We're not mixing with anything else. I mean, we'll occasionally put a little bit into one of our dooryards for the hell of it, but, you know, the dooryard being our sort of movable feast that changes all the time.
Yeah. So, hey, Steve, hold on. Let Dave.
It's all by itself.
Dave Broderick has one last question.
Yeah, Steve, I want to know, like, we had a lot of erratic weather this past spring, and were you affected by that at all in terms of the late frost? And are you worried about that in the future? It seems like the weather is getting a lot more erratic, and that especially affects fruit trees.
Yes. Anybody who tells you that, people can argue about why the climate's changing. Anybody who tells you that the climate isn't changing is not out there every day in the climate. I am worried about it. I mean, a lot of one of the elements of terroir, one of the elements most important elements of the conditions that a piece of ground imposes on the things that can be grown well there is climate. And then the climate starts changing dramatically. That whole picture starts to change. We lost less fruit than many of our colleagues because a lot of our cider apples and a lot of the heirlooms we grow are actually late flowering. So the extremely, insanely early spring this year, followed by what was actually a perfectly normal freeze, it just came late in the life of the tree because the tree woke up early. You know, we lost less than a lot of our colleagues. And you know, we had a 21 degree day, a morning a few days ago, and I think most of the fruit came through. The cider fruit came through. It destroyed the all the stuff we would have picked to pack, you know, for fresh fruit. But I mean, the answer is yes, we are being affected by the climate change.
But these cider varietals, these ones that are grown specifically for hard cider, they do have that advantage of flowering later.
Some of them do. Look, guys, you got to stop saying varietal. That's a great term. I don't even understand it. It's an adjective.
What is the whole
apple world calls them varieties. So if you're going to talk about apples, please talk about varieties and leave the
varieties.
But yeah, it's not completely characteristic of cider fruit, and meaning that they are late flowering, and we lost the early flowering cider fruit. Our Wixen crop got more or less hammered this year. Our Ashmead's Curl crop got more or less hammered this year. Those are early flowering varieties. But, you know, Dabinet and Yarlington Mill and Chiseled Jersey and Esopus Spitzenberg, those are later flowering varieties, and they were still sleeping when it got cold this spring, so they weren't destroyed. But what's happening when that happens, that time of year, you know, you've got these little buds that are opening. Each one's got five flowers in it, and you know, once it warms up, they start to open, and then those flowers start to, not the flowers, but the flower organs start to kind of come out.
Hey, Steve, we got to cut you off for a second. Hold on, sorry.
It's like freezing a head of lettuce, pal. You can't throw a head of lettuce in your freezer by mistake overnight, and then take it out the next morning and make a salad. It ain't lettuce anymore. So.
Hey, Steve, listen, can you hold on the line for a minute? We're going to take a short break.
Sure, yeah.
All right, we'll take a short break. We'll be back in a few minutes to talk about cider on Beer Sessions Radio.
Network.
Can I call you, darling?
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Here we are with Cider Week New York. We're talking to Steve Wood up in New Hampshire at Farnham Hill Cider. And our home cider makers, Joy and Jeremy, they've got something to share with you, Steve. So we're tasting apples right now.
Yeah, we just pulled out an Ashmead's kernel to show everyone what it tastes like. And then we actually fermented an Ashmead kernel by itself because Joy here likes, you know, taking a single variety of an apple and fermenting it to see what it does. So we're tasting the cider and the apple at the same time here.
Because we're still learning. And he's gone.
But keep
basically,
talking.
You know, I'm still learning about what these apples do. I can go into the orchard and I can bite an apple and think that it might make an interesting cider, but I don't know myself until I actually have fermented it into a beverage. And we brought a single variety of Ashmead's kernel here, which we're drinking, and I enjoy it, but it's very tart, and it's not as complex as a more blended cider, which is typically what we do because we like.
Well, I like what Steve said. He said the Kingston Black was a sort of, and he doesn't blend it. But I do think one of his strengths is that he's a really excellent blender of ciders.
Mm-hmm.
And at one of the Cider Week press previews this year, he did a demonstration of how he blended ciders. And Steve's really he's a great orchardist. He's a really good blender too. So that's what really sets him apart. He really knows his stuff. We're also going to have another guest on. I know Dan, are you on the air right now?
Hey, I'm right here.
All right, Dan Wilson, Hicks Orchard and Slybrough Ciders. Welcome to the show. We have Sarah Grady from Cider New York, Dave Broderick from Blind Tiger, and Joy and Jeremy, who are awesome home cider makers here in New York. How are you doing, Dan?
I'm great.
Great. Are you going to be down? Are you down in New York, or are you going to be coming down to New York for Cider Week?
It seems like a fairly full week. I think I'm going to be down for one or two events toward the end of the week.
Great. I know that you know Sarah from Cider Week New York. The first time I met you and the first time I ever really worked with local New York ciders, we did a 100-mile dinner maybe 5 or 6 years ago at Jimmy's Number 43, and we got some of your Slybrough ciders. We had the ice wine and the sparkling, and we used that in our dinner. And it was only last year with the first Cider Week New York that we really started bringing back all the different regional ciders. How do you feel about Cider Week and are you excited to be bringing product into New York City?
Yeah, it's a great opportunity for us, and we are kind of a small cidery based on a very old New York apple orchard that, we've been at it for almost 10 years now, and so we're kind of growing as our orchard and the market kind of demands that we grow, and right now we are just breaking into a little bit more of the New York City market, and we're excited about introducing more people to our ciders too.
Who's Sarah?
Hey, Dan. So one of the things we were talking about a little while ago were cider apple varieties, and we spoke a bit about the French Exchange project that you were a part of. And, I know one of the things that came out of that experience for many of the participants in it was a real enthusiasm about the French cider varieties. And there's been a lot of talk about introducing some of these, historically more French or more English apple varieties to cider orchards. And one thing that you and I have talked about, I think it'd be interesting to hear you speak a little bit about this, is, not overlooking those American hard cider varieties, those more historic American hard cider varieties. Can you tell us a little bit about those and some of that history?
I think that certainly there's potential. I think there are a lot of people that are doing research in the direction of figuring out what were the most popular varieties for American ciders back in, when that was a much more commonly consumed drink. I know a lot of the russet varieties and pippin varieties seem to be right at the top of the list of things that people are excited about trying, but I just think that we're really at the very beginning of figuring all that out, and there's a lot of talk that I've heard, including on your show, about single variety ciders, and that's really how we got started. Was just trying to do single variety ciders with everything that we could grow, or that we currently grow, and everything we can get our hands on, And we kind of concluded, as I think Steve rightly pointed out, that the making of a good cider is kind of a blender's art. That there are good strong characteristics from a number of varieties. There are a lot of varieties that make a very insipid cider that really can't contribute anything to, I think, a good finished product. But the idea is that you learn from fermenting single varieties what the strengths and weaknesses are, so you can kind of construct an interesting cider from those. The source of those varieties, I think, can be very broad. I think there are a lot of American varieties that we should be working with, but probably more off the beaten path. Some of the more traditional varieties, I think, might be a more interesting venue rather than some of the dessert varieties that are all about being sweet and crunchy. As far as French varieties or English varieties, there are more of those that we're able to play with in the United States from, and I think a lot of the varieties that Steve Wood is growing, which kind of leads to what the rest of us are starting to grow, are more the traditional English varieties. As far as what we saw in Normandy last year, there's 150 varieties there that I have yet to see very much of at all in the United States. And in fact, only have noticed from one or two orchards some of the same varieties that we saw grown in France that are kind of their standard varieties. So there's a lot of work to be done.
All right, man.
Yeah, Steve, I had a question. I bought a farm up in Vermont, and it was a stagecoach stop and tavern back in 1784, and they planted a lot of cider trees around it to supply it. And so a lot of the trees are 200-plus years old, and I have no idea. I make cider from them. I have no idea what the varieties are. And I heard you say in the beginning that you sort of inherited an old orchard.
Nearly that old. Our oldest trees are about 120 years old,
okay.
And they're fairly clearly identified. And a lot of those actually are fairly standard varieties.
Okay.
What I talk to people who it seems like in our area, every farm, whether it was a dairy farm or not, had some remnants of an orchard, because I think, which is indicative of the fact that cider was a very commonly consumed drink, 100 or 150 years ago. And the varieties are a question mark. And it's probably not as important to know exactly what some of those varieties are if they make good cider. But there's a lot of interesting things that I've seen come through our dooryard in exactly that way. I can't identify them, but they have some interesting quality.
And Dan, you guys actually, are you in New York and Vermont?
We're right on the border of Vermont. I'm just a stone's throw away. We're right in the same kind of farmland, small farms, rolling hills in the kind of lower Champlain, upper Hudson area.
So you're saying that if the house I grew up in, there was a gnarly old apple tree in the backyard, and the apples always never came out looking like something you'd want to eat. So you're saying back then people probably made those into hard cider.
Oh yeah. I think you have to, during that time, there was no way of storing food for long term. So you typically, I think that if you had a root cellar, you could store apples for probably a couple months, fresh apples, and you probably drank some fresh juice too. But the real value of a lot of those apples were to ferment. If it's a tree, really, it's 200 years old, then they're exactly the same apple that was produced, or the same flavored apple as was produced back then. And a lot of those apples are fairly astringent or tart and may not have much in the way of a good eating quality, but might make a very interesting cider.
So hard cider was a way of life for a long time in America, and it was probably the only way that people could actually preserve apples. Right.
Exactly.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, I guess the other part of that too is the whole rewriting of the story of Johnny Appleseed, where we are taught as kids that he brought apples to the pioneers on the frontier in Ohio and Indiana back when that was the Western frontier. But the real understanding and the context of what we understand about cider now is that he was as well regarded for bringing alcohol to the frontier. And the value of that was for a homesteader, where they were probably really struggling to establish themselves in an area. It provided a safe thing to drink, because they were probably reliant on surface water for stream water, which would have made them sick to drink. But if they had an apple juice that they could ferment, the process of fermentation would have killed a lot of the bacteria. So it would translate to a safe thing for them to drink, and so that's why it was pretty commonly consumed by man, woman, and child, and it really helped them to solidify their grasp on their
definitely. Hey Dan, you make some of my we're going to wind up soon. You make some of my favorite Northeastern ciders. I love your ice wine. I love your sparkling cider, and we have some home cider makers here. I want you to talk to Jeremy and Dan. Talk about what you do as a home cider maker. How is that similar to what Slybro's doing, and vice versa? How is it different?
Well, listen, Dan, I'm still afraid of the water. There's weird stuff in there, right? So, like John Adams, I drink a tankard of cider every morning because it settles my stomach and prevents gas. And that's why we make the cider, you know? And we can't find stuff that we make because it's funky and weird, and you can't really sell stuff that's funky and weird. I think it's been a while since I've had the Slybro, but...
Well,
I don't know.
If you have funky and weird friends, then you can sell it to them. But,
all right, so Dan, give us a rundown. How do you make your ciders? You start with the apples, and tell us the basic steps so we can follow you on the air.
Sure. Well, we are, like I said earlier, we did not take at face value the common notion that you can't make cider out of certain varieties. So we had to prove that to ourselves. And so we grow, or at that time, we grew about 20 different varieties of apples, most of them eating varieties, and we made cider out of them, out in single-batch varieties. And we started out like most home brewers did, in working in carboys and 5-gallon buckets and in a room in the back of the apple barn that my wife called the Mad Scientist Room. And It invariably attracted all kinds of people who kind of mysteriously figured out what we were doing back there, and so we got a lot of good information from other homebrewers that way too. And we found that through our experiments, what we could make interesting ciders from, because again, as I said before, there are pretty subtle flavors in cider, and to make something that has some richness or complexity, you need to kind of blend notes to get something that has a little bit more depth or a little bit more character. And the elements you're playing with are, you know, the sweetness of the fruit, the certain flavor qualities of fruit, and then in acidity, which is another very important part of the kind of the crisp quality of cider. But then there are the more earthy notes and the tannic notes that... especially some of these, bittersweet and bitter sharp, and some heritage varieties can contribute to a cider.
Are you guys blending those in the field? So are you fermenting them together, or are you blending them after the fermentation, or both?
As we get more confidence, we're doing that. But we find that there's a lot of difference, again, in not just from varieties, but from one season to the next. And we found that we have most control over the flavor of our finished ciders if we continue to ferment in single variety batches.
Yeah.
And so originally that was a 5-gallon bucket. Now it's an 800-gallon tank.
So you get to see what each apple does separately and then put them together.
Yeah, and so what that allows us to do is to, if we have one of our most popular varieties, or ciders, is called Hidden Star, which is mostly Northern Spy, which is kind of a traditional New England baking apple, a little bit on the tart side, and then a fairly new variety called Liberty, which is one that, it's a scab-resistant variety that we can grow organically. And it's also a fairly tart variety, and together they produce a fairly crisp-flavored cider. But when we do it in single-variety batches, it allows us to kind of change the ratio from one year to another just to kind of get a more consistent flavor in the finished cider, because we kind of have to tweak the balance of the the ratio of between the two varieties to get the right note that we're looking for.
Oh, dude, that's awesome. One thing I love about being on air is I like the listening to, true, people like yourself who are really excellent in your field, and you have a lot to share. And I'm looking forward to having you on again, because we could definitely keep this conversation going further. Our show is wrapping up. So I'd like to give a shout out to everyone who's been on board tonight. We got Dave Broderick from Blind Tiger, Sarah Grady from Cider Week NY. Join Jeremy from Proper Cider, who are all going to have a lot more to say about this in the future. And thank you to Steve Wood and you, Dan, from Sly Bro. We'll give a quick shout-out. There's some events. Cider Week New York still going on. You can go to ciderweeknewyork.com and check out. There's a lot more things happening, including Mary Cleaver, our good friend, is hosting a tasting this weekend. Yes. And when is that?
That's actually a private event.
Ooh.
Well, can't go, Jimmy.
Go to Cider Week NY. I got invited, though. All right, Dave, anything going on? You have any cider at Blind Tiger this week?
We got Farnham Hill on. But tomorrow night, we've got Dogfish Head for their annual event.
All right. And Joy and Jeremy, anything going on with your home cider making? Are you going to do a club or something?
We're going to do some in-house tasting. So check out Proper Cider on Facebook. Come over and taste with us. Or don't,
We're in production right now. We picked up 10 bushels of apples last weekend, and we've got a lot of crushing and pressing and cider to make still this week.
Well, come over and check it out.
We heard it's very inspiring listening to Steve Wood, who we know has really been at the forefront of, we're going to call them the grower cider makers, and Dan from Slybro as well. You guys really have a lot to say, and we're definitely going to talk to you guys more in the future. And hey, thanks everybody for tuning in to Beer Sessions Radio. Thanks again, Dave, Sarah, Steve, Joy, Jeremy, and Dan for joining me here on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni. Thanks to our producers, Jack Inslee and Brie O'Connor, and engineer Joe Galarraga. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on Beer Sessions Radio.
Cider Sessions.
Cider Sessions.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.